Today is September the 2nd, 2020.
It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org.
The Internet broke down again. Whether you're ready or not, and whether you want it or not, cloud computing is now part of the fabric of our everyday living. Widespread Internet outages knocked down Cloudflare, the PlayStation Network, Xbox Live, Amazon, Hulu, and a slew of other sites this Sunday morning. And it's apparently all because of a single Internet service provider, CenturyLink. Given that Cloudflare's online security services are designed to keep websites up and running when it went down, so did dozens of the popular sites and services that rely on it, including Discord, Feedly, and League of Legends. Cloudflare began seeing an increased level of HTTP5 class errors early Sunday morning, and it later tweeted that issues with a third-party transit provider were affecting all of Cloudflare's data centers that use that provider. CenturyLink confirmed on Twitter that its technicians were working to fix an IP outage, which was resolved shortly before noon. CenturyLink said that they also were able to confirm that all services impacted by the IP outages have been restored. CenturyLink said they understand how important these services are to their customers, and they sincerely apologize for the impact this outage caused. Down Detector showed reports of internet connectivity problems coming in from across the United States and Western Europe on Sunday morning. Cloudflare chief tech officer said the extent of the problems required manual intervention in addition to its automated bug detection systems. It's not the first time most of the internet's gone dark because of issues with CenturyLink services. A nationwide blackout in 2018 took down Verizon's mobile data, ATMs, and most worryingly, the 911 emergency line in several parts of the United States. When an emergency strikes, it's critical that Americans are able to use 911 to reach those who can help. The CenturyLink service outage is completely unacceptable, and the breadth and duration is particularly troubling. As annoying as this Sunday morning may have been, I suppose we can be thankful that the outage wasn't all that bad, at least. I think. But it'll happen again. Courts hold Amazon is liable for faulty products. As reported in the Washington Post, courts hold Amazon liable for faulty products, and multiple court rulings have found that the e-commerce giant is responsible for defects in products sold by third-party merchants on its marketplace. Nearly 60% of all physical goods sold on Amazon's e-commerce marketplace come from third-party merchants, a fact that's lost on many shoppers. Amazon has argued in court that this relationship absolves it of any liability related to defective products sold by those vendors. For many years, the courts have largely sided with Amazon. California and a handful of others in Texas, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania have halted Amazon's winning streak. Legislation was under debate in California aimed to place liability squarely on e-commerce retailers that provide a platform for dubious merchants selling dangerous goods. Amazon has emerged as the nation's largest online retailer, in part by turning its store into an online bazaar where more than 2.5 million third-party vendors sell their goods. The company has prioritized that vast selection, allowing merchants to sell on the site with virtually no vetting at all. The company has said that among its screening processes, it uses machine learning technology to identify risky sellers as well as using investigators to review applications. The business of selling other merchants' goods is enormously lucrative for Amazon. In the last quarter, Amazon generated $18.2 billion with a B of revenue from seller services such as fees and commissions, a figure that jumped 52% from the same period a year ago. Listings of products federal agencies have deemed unsafe has led regulators and lawmakers to criticize the company for putting profits over safety. That's because even when a shopper buys an item from a third party on Amazon's platform, Amazon keeps roughly 15% cut of the sale. The challenge for Amazon is that it has allowed so many sellers into its marketplace. It also made it difficult to police for dangerous goods. Some Chinese manufacturers and sellers, which it aggressively recruited to create a catalog of products so extensive that no other retailer could match it, do not manufacture products to standards set by U.S. lawmakers and regulators. Amazon has also come under fire for counterfeited goods sold by third-party merchants. In July, Amazon notified third-party vendors that they will no longer be able to anonymously sell goods on its U.S. e-commerce site as of September 1st, a move that could also help curb sales of dangerous and counterfeit items that have plagued the site in recent years. Until recently, legal experts says courts often found Amazon's relationship with those sellers at enough of an arm's length that it was insulated from liability for defective goods. Product liability laws vary, of course, from state to state, but generally were written decades ago, before internet retail existed. Amazon racked up a string of legal victories, arguing that it merely was a conduit that connected sellers to shoppers, sheltered from claims that it was responsible to defective goods third-party merchants sold on its site. Many of its third-party sellers are effectively judgment-proof. When products from Chinese sellers hurt shoppers in the United States, the merchants often disappear, leaving consumers unable to hold them accountable. Recently, courts have started to apply the same rules to Amazon that exist for brick-and-mortar retailers, which can be held liable for products they sold. The Fourth District Court of Appeal in California ruled that, like a physical retailer, Amazon is part of the distribution chain and could have exerted influence on product safety in a way few consumers could. And since the third-party seller, a Chinese company, couldn't be found by the litigants, Amazon was the only viable defendant. The Fourth District Court issued the following ruling. Because Amazon adheres to a business model that fails to prioritize consumer safety, it should be made to bear the consequences. Indeed, blessing Amazon's evasion of product liability would give an incentive to companies to design business models like Amazon's that do nothing to protect consumers from defective products. The ruling is not binding outside of California, though, but courts often consider decisions from other states as they make their own determinations. Amazon intends to appeal the decision. Amazon made the following statement. The court's decision was wrongly decided and is contrary to well-established law in California and around the country that service providers are not liable for third-party products they do not make or sell. A key to the ruling and other recent liability rulings against Amazon is that the company warehoused and shipped the defective products. Rulings have held that Amazon's possession of those products in its warehouses as well as its shipping them in boxes covered in the company's logo puts it squarely in the distribution chain. Taking possession of goods from third-party sellers have been the key to Amazon's success. Sending products to Amazon warehouses under a program called Fulfillment by Amazon makes those items eligible for speedy prime shipping, which can often be the difference in a third-party merchant making a sale. A Texas judge determined that placing a defective product into the stream of commerce was a factor rule in June that Amazon could be held liable for the sale of the item by a third party on its site. In denying Amazon's effort to have the case dismissed in June, federal judge found that the company could have pulled a dangerous product. The decision wasn't a complete defeat for Amazon, though. The judge ruled that Amazon couldn't be held liable for failing to warn shoppers that the product was dangerous. That's because the product description was provided by the seller, not Amazon, giving it immunity under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. That rule, which some lawmakers want to change, also generally insulates social media companies such as Facebook, Google, and Twitter from liability for harmful content posted on their sites. The plaintiff didn't have an understanding that third-party sellers operate on Amazon, and plaintiff said he assumed that the product was vetted because he didn't think Amazon would put its name behind a product that was dangerous. Today, I don't buy any electronic products shipped directly to me from China. I've had my fill with counterfeit batteries. What makes this a major news item most interesting is Amazon and the Washington Post, which reported on it, are owned by Jeff Bezos. The reporter was very objective in his reporting. I hope he still has his job. Connecting a computer to your brain. Neuralink has demonstrated a prototype of its brain-machine interface that currently works in pigs. Last Friday, Elon Musk revealed more details about his mysterious neuroscience company, Neuralink, and its plans to connect computers to human brains. While the development of this futuristic-sounding tech is still in the early stages, the presentation was expected to demonstrate the second version of a small robotic device that inserts tiny electrode threads throughout the skull and into the brain. Musk said ahead of the event that he would show neutrons firing in real time. He did just that. At that event, Musk showed off several pigs that had prototypes of the neural links implanted in their head and machinery that was tracking the pig's brain's activity in real time. The billionaire also announced that the Food and Drug Administration had awarded the company a breakthrough device authorization, which can help expedite research on a medical device. This Musk-backed endeavor is incredibly ambitious, but Neuralink builds on years of research into brain-machine interfaces. A brain-machine interface is technology that allows for a device, like a computer, to interact and communicate with the brain. Neuralink, in particular, aims to build an incredible, powerful brain-machine interface, a device with the power to handle lots of data that can be inserted in a relatively simple surgery. Its short-term goal is to build a device that can help people with specific health conditions. Musk has already said that the project allowed a monkey to control a computer device with its mind. And as reported in the New York Times in 2019, Neuralink had demonstrated a system with 1,500 electrodes connected to a lab rat. Since then, Musk had hinted at the company's progress, though those involved had generally been close-lipped about the status of the research. Musk opened last Friday's event by emphasizing the wide variety of spinal and neurological conditions, including seizures, paralysis, brain damage, and depression, that Neuralink technology could help treat. These can be solved with an implantable neural link, said Musk. The neurons are like wiring, and you kind of need an electronic thing to solve an electronic problem. But it's worth highlighting that Musk wants Neuralink to do far more than treat specific health conditions. He sees the technology as an opportunity to build a widely available brain-computer interface for consumers, which he thinks could help humans keep pace with increasingly powerful artificial intelligence. So while modest, Neuralink's research already foreshadows how this technology could one day change the life as we know it. At the same time, it's a reminder that the potential, eventual merging of humans with computers is destined to introduce a wide range of ethical and social questions that we should probably start thinking about now. Founded in 2016, Neuralink is a neuroscience technology company focused on building systems with super-thin threads that carry electrodes. When implanted into a brain, these threads would form a high-capacity channel for a computer to communicate with the brain, a system supposed to be much more powerful than the existing brain-machine interfaces being researched. One major barrier to inserting these incredibly tiny wires, which are thinner than a strand of human hair, is actually getting them past the skull and into the brain. That's why Neuralink is also developing an incredibly small robot that connects the electrode to humans through surgery that's about as intensive as a laser eye procedure. On Friday, Musk outlined how the company hopes to do the procedure without general anesthesia in a single-day hospital stay. That's the goal, at least, and it would represent a huge leap forward from previous brain-machine interfaces, which have required more invasive surgeries. Essentially, a brain-machine interface can use electricity the brain already uses to function along with a series of electrodes to connect the brain with a machine. Neuralink cites previous examples in which humans have used electrodes to control cursors and robotic limbs with their minds as the basis for the system. But what's novel about Neuralink's plan is making the process of connecting a device with the brain minimal, while also massively increasing the number of electrodes engaged. The company wants to make brain-machine interfaces not only easier to install, but also more powerful. Musk further explained that in the past year, Neuralink simplified its plans for a wearable device that connects to the threads implanted in the user's brain. While the first generation of this device would have been installed behind a person's ear, the newest version is a small coin-sized device that would sit under the top of their skull. Their research is still in the early stages, and as it advances, would likely require focusing on how the technology can help people with specific severe health conditions first. I just hope we don't end up building Frankenstein. There is a global laptop shortage. Students are going back to school, but they may not have everything they need to learn. This year's back-to-school shopping list might have a new entry, a laptop, needed for the upcoming months or more of remote learning. Not only might it be the most expensive item on your list, it may also be the hardest one to find. As students begin the new school year, some who will be attending virtually are scrambling to find the necessary equipment to do so. Shortages of laptops and tablets have caused delays that will stretch weeks, even months, into the school year. Many schools have plenty of time to plan for the fall and order supplies accordingly. And some of them did just that. The problem is there simply aren't enough laptops and tablets to go around, especially when it comes to low-cost Chromebooks. Chromebooks are laptops that run Chrome, a simple operating system designed by Google, and normally cost less than $300. They're used by the majority of American school systems due to their comparatively low cost and Google's push into the rapidly growing and increasingly lucrative education space, including apps like Google Classroom. The laptop shortage has been worsening. One industry analyst had predicted that the situation would right itself by June. Well, it's past June and it has not. The time for the new school year and its increased demand is there. Obviously, this has not happened. One reason, according to the AP, is the administration sanctions issued in July on Chinese companies that are believed to use forced labor. While the ban only applies to American companies selling products to the sanctioned Chinese companies, the New York Times said it was likely that American businesses would stop doing business with those Chinese companies entirely. Lenovo blamed the sanctions for its backlog of 3 million Chromebooks. HP, on the other hand, told school system that its shortage of 1.7 million laptops is due to pandemic-related production shortages of components made in China. New Apple support scam is now on the rise. Lately, I've been getting phone calls from Apple support every day, offering me tech support because they have discovered a data breach requiring immediate attention. No matter what I tell them, I don't have an Apple product, or take my name off your list, do not call, they come back every day. Hackers are at it again, and this scam is sophisticated. And the goal is to steal your sensitive information and take control of your iCloud information. This is how it works. Hackers been spoofing Apple's support number. That's right, they're using Apple's support number. And, well, supposedly Apple's support number. And calling to offer technical support. The scammer will claim that there's a data breach requiring immediate attention. Your Apple iCloud account had been compromised, hacked, or has been showing suspicious activity. To fix the problem requires granting the scammer access to your device, handing over your Apple login credentials, passwords, credit card information, and other sensitive data, giving the scammer everything they need to eventually take over your iCloud account. Sometimes the scammer takes the form of an automated message sent directly to your phone announcing suspicious activity has been found on your iCloud account. Scammers will leave a message instructing you to call a specific number to reach Apple support. Well, let's say that number looks legitimate. The number may lead some to think it's a legitimate sounding welcome message. The number leads you to think that it's a legitimate number because if you were to call it, you get a welcome message complete with an estimated wait time mirroring the real Apple support process. Once connected to a scammer, they will work to capture iCloud account credentials, login information, credit card information, and in some cases, they will even ask for access to your device for remote assistance. So, what makes the scam so believable? The use of high-level spoofing technology makes it appear as if Apple is actually calling. Oftentimes, the word Apple support will appear on your call ID, or the Apple logo will appear on the call coming in. It can be challenging to separate fact from fiction. If you receive a call like the one I just described, and you're unsure and the caller is legitimate Apple support representative, Apple support will never ask you for your Apple ID password or iCloud credentials. Apple support will never ask for verification codes to provide you with support. What can you do? Well, in doubt, hang up, search for Apple support on the internet, or call 1-800-694-7466 to verify the legitimacy of the call. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. Tech and other issues upon return to office.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. We're going to talk about, of all things, business. Yeah, what do you know? I'm giving you a lot of experience from being an IT professional, but also, in this case, I'm going to give you some insights of some of the different things that come to mind from our return to the office. Now, mind you, we've been out of the office, 6 months or something like that. And this is something that may continue for many of us for quite a long time. But at some point, we may have to go into the office, at least on occasion, into our desks, and we may need to address some things in the office. I'm telling you right now, having been through a few of these different experiences, this moves far beyond some of the ideas of, yes, the fridge, the science experiment, the science experiment in our coffee mugs, tea mug, whatever it is, you know, you've got. You need to be prepared. When you go back into the office, you or one of your neighbors in the office is going to have forgotten something very important, and there will be, yes, certain issues that you'll need to be dealing with, gross issues. But beyond that, there's going to be other technology issues that we may or may not have brought into consideration. Some offices have completely shut down the air conditioning and heating for months on end, what is your office going to smell like? But even more concerning is the technology that's going to be going on. We don't know how long this is going to last, but I'll tell you, over the course of the last 6 months, there are different companies which have pushed forward and they've continued with different technology improvements to the systems. And there are other companies that have sat back and said, well, if we're not in the office, IT isn't going to go into the office and IT isn't going to fix anything. So your computer may be running at 100% today and 100% tomorrow and 99.5% the following day and then 99%. And it slowly dries up. The numbers start falling off. Different little things, and we fix these different things. I will tell you that the IT nerd is going to be overwhelmed upon return to the office. Why? Because there are problems that are going to abound. I want you to picture one item. The laser printer, or the copier, whichever one you've got. Copier toner, laser printer toner, sits in there, and it is supposed to, there's a different little churning that they do of the toner every once in a while to make sure it doesn't cake up, to make sure that it's reliable. If your printer has been on the entire time, you've got a certain level of electrical budget that's been doing an upkeep there. But then none of it's been printing, so you could have problems there. You could have problems on the flip side. It's been off. Both of those issues can create printer issues. We then move to the idea of different server systems. If you haven't updated the server in the last 6 months, yes, you may be doing software updates. The IT professional may be doing them, rather. He may be doing a lot of the stuff you remote, but there's certain things that you want to make sure that you keep on top of. Nobody's been in the server room for a while. Hopefully, it's got a good filtration system. Hopefully, it's got a good air conditioner. I will tell you that many offices have no monitoring of the air conditioning. And if a server has been running in that server room for the last 6 months and somebody did something crazy like turned off the air conditioner or the air conditioner failed, that server, while it may be within certain operating parameters, you have a success rate. If it's under 100, it should be fairly well operational. But we want it to run somewhere around 70 degrees. A normal, comfortable temperature for you and I. Can you imagine? It's kind of like driving your car all the time at 120 miles an hour. You're going to wear it out faster. You're going to just be a lot harder on it. It's going to die faster than it will if you just keep running it at 60 miles an hour. It's a very similar comparison here. Unfortunately, we may not have any clue on that. Your technician gets to the office, it's 105 in the server room. He has no idea how long it's been. So we have these ripples that are going to occur throughout IT, throughout the office in general. Dust. Nobody's in the office. One of the big, huge contributors of dust is the human body, but also there's other bits and pieces of dust that have been floating around in that office area because, well, we still have air. We still have, in some areas, smog, and that still settles down in the office. Look, these are all problems we're going to have to deal with. Returning to the office, I want you to stretch your mind. I've only thrown a few of these at you. I've had a couple of different discussions with people just in the last month or so where they start talking about these things and what we have to look forward to or really prepare for when we return to the office. Are you prepared? Are you, your company, are you going to be successful when all of this is all over? This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Well, if you're thinking of cord cutting, one of the things that you may miss from what is available on cable is local news, such as those in New York. With the Spectrum offering, Channel 1 is local news. And, of course, you can get over-the-air channels, but you may have to reorient that little 8x11 sheet or legal size 11x14 antenna sheet in different directions to get different channels. Well, there are three free alternatives to not only the Weather Channel, but also to the local news. Local Now, LOCALNOW, is a free streaming service powered by the Weather Channel. The news app covers major stories, including weather updates, and the app is available on Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, iOS and Android, along with YouTube TV and Sling TV carrying the channel. Weather Nation is a free channel with forecasts tailored to each user. Track current weather conditions, browse weather maps, and get alerts from the National Weather Service. The app is available on Android, iOS, Amazon Fire TV, Roku, Apple TV, PlayStation 3 and 4, Xbox 360, and many smart TVs. And then there's NewsOn, N-E-W-S-O-N, offers the latest news from over 275 local station partners in over 155 markets around the country, and includes severe weather updates. The app is available on Roku, Amazon Fire TV, iOS, and Android devices. Troubleshooting test equipment. Over the years, I have accumulated different test instruments for PC troubleshooting. The components have evolved as technology has changed. There was one instrument that was almost an absolute must. After initial assembly of the computer system unit, most people in the early days had to trace the signals to locate where there were errors in the wiring. The instrument used was the oscilloscope. When I was assembling power amplifiers, preamplifiers, FM tuners, and PC system units, the oscilloscope was invaluable. The unit itself was not portable, and it was expensive. It's no longer in my arsenal of equipment. Today, the basic functions of an oscilloscope is available in a very small package, costing as little as $60. The oscilloscope tests and display voltage signals as waveforms, visual representations of the variation of voltage over time. The signals are plotted on a graph, which shows how the signal changes. Another basic piece of test equipment is still in active use today. It is a multimeter. Yes, that little tiny thing. A multimeter or test meter, also known as a VOM or volt ohmmeter, is an electronic measuring instrument that combines several measurement functions in one unit. A typical multimeter can measure voltage, current, and resistance. Back about 50 years ago, I acquired the Triplett Model 310, which is a hand-sized analog multimeter with all of the versatility and performance of larger, more expensive bench-sized models. It offered a diode overload protection against damage to the meter movements caused by accidental overloads. A fuse was inside to be used to protect the unit, small enough to be carried in your toolbox, glove compartments, briefcase, or shirt pocket. The Model 310 featured 20,000 ohms per volt DC sensitivity and 5,000 ohm per volt AC. This model had 18 different ranges that can be easily read on only three clearly defined scale areas. A single selector switch allows you to switch easily from range to range and function to function. Included test leads, alligator clips, and batteries. It was very well built. In kit building, this was extensively used to find shorts and to test for key voltage readings during unit assembly. One day, I made the mistake of setting it incorrectly, and the unit literally blew up. I had wanted to do a connectivity test, and I unwittingly had the probe testing a live power supply. There was a lesson learned. It was do not do any hardware debugging after midnight. This meter was introduced back in 1955. I assumed it was no longer in production and decided to move on, and I got myself a Fluke 8021B multimeter, a much larger size unit. This unit was purchased about 39 years ago, and it weighed 13 ounces. It measured over 7 inches by 3.4 inches by 1.8 inches. Compared to the triplet 310, it is heavier and larger, but it gave me digital readouts, even though it was like a little tiny brick that I had to carry around. After all these years, I decided that it was time to replace the small brick Fluke 8021B, because with all the things I was carrying around, I wanted a unit that was portable and lightweight. I decided to find, if it was possible, a budget multi-tester, perhaps costing no more than $25, so if I lose it or it gets knocked around, not a big deal at all. So I've been looking in that range, and with many of the no-name units that I looked at that price point, these units just didn't have the look and feel of a quality product. I wanted a simple meter to do AC-DC readings without flipping through range of values to use the meter, and similarly, I want to have a meter for resistance testing without flipping through the range of values. I wanted a pocket portable unit weighing less than half a pound, or that's 8 ounces, and something that is simple to use so that when it's borrowed by family members, I don't have to explain to them how to use the meter. Well, I did some searching, and to my surprise, there is such a unit. It's the Triplet Model 200. The Triplet MM200 compact multimeter measures AC-DC voltages, resistance, temperature, and continuity. I've been using it to diagnose common wiring problems, test batteries and power outlets, check polarity in wiring installations, and use to measure circuit input-output resistance. The unit features data hold, which was really a very pleasant surprise to have, because all you have to do is just hit the button and the reading is held until you click it off. Auto power off with disable, and battery strength indication on power up. There is built-in non-contact voltage detector, three-color light indication, and an audible beeper. The package itself included test leads, temperature probe, and they threw in a couple AAA batteries so it could be used immediately. The dimensions are 5.1 inches by 2.6 inches by 1.1 inch, and it tipped the scale at 4.6 ounces. That was a pleasant surprise. For me, compared to what I was using, this is what I was looking for. It's compact, portable, and the rubberized edges gives the impression it could take a fall from a moderate height without getting destroyed. The main function dial turns easily even with one hand. The hold backlight and relative buttons, they feel solid. I was surprised the street price was under $20. This unit is a keeper. By the way, in researching for a budget multimeter, I discovered that the Triplet Model 310, as I indicated, that was introduced in 1955, is still in production. What a workhorse that is. So while the Triplet Model 200 will meet most of my needs, I think I'm going to go get a Triplet Model 310 just to fill the void of having an old friend with me, because that meter and I shared a lot of history.
Finding space for the home office in the home. To better understand the makeshift nature of workspaces in the home, it's important to look at how the home office first emerged as a distinct space. In the 18th century, three separate spheres of domestic activity started to appear in middle-class and wealthy single-family homes. There was a social area for hosting guests, such as dining and living rooms, a service zone, which included the kitchen, cellar, and laundry areas, and a sleeping area, which was the most private of the house. What we now call the home office emerged from generically called chamber rooms, used by men and women prior to the 19th century. The majority of the chamber rooms were later simply labeled bedrooms on builders' floor plans. However, beginning in the 19th century, some of these spaces depicted on floor plans were interchangeably referred to as the library, den, or the study, a place for men to conduct business. By the late 19th century, the study became primarily a space reserved for male professionals to conduct business at home, indulge in scholarly pursuits, and entertain friends. For example, clergy, merchants, and doctors needed a study or interview room because their work was more likely to be conducted at home. The study was often separated from the private zones of the house and placed as close to the front door as possible in the home's social zone to maintain family privacy. By then, in the early 20th century, the study largely disappeared from standard middle-class homes, which were getting smaller, remaining only in houses built for upper-middle-class professionals and the wealthy. Though the study was used for leisure and occasional work, the home was seen as a place for family life. Working from home was a convenience. In the 1950s, Bell Telephone teamed up with builders of middle-class homes to market the installation of additional telephone lines as a way to combine work and leisure under one roof. When PCs replaced typewriters, computer companies such as Apple and IBM geared their ads towards professionals, depicting their products as tools that would allow them to telecommute, run a business out of the home, or make it easier for the kids to complete homework. As these technologies started appearing in more and more homes, families started to wonder where to put them. By then, most middle-class homes no longer had the study room. During the pandemic period, where to put office equipment has become an issue for work at home and school study at home. Placing it in the master bedroom interfered with the perceived functions of the bedroom, intimacy and relaxation. A PC in the living room competed with a television, while office equipment in the kitchen or dining room impeded the ability to work uninterrupted by other family members. The home office works well as a quiet room to concentrate and work. We were working from home before the pandemic, and the number has since risen as offices around the home shuttered. But we're still stuck with the same issue of too much work and not enough space to do it. Presenting Marty Winston with Home Automation.
How not to be afraid of test gear.
Growing up, there were speedometers and odometers and altimeters and barometers and thermometers. So the first time I read about a very basic test instrument, I thought its name was multimeter. No, should have known. There were also gas meters, electric meters, and light meters. Not gas meter and electric meter and light meter. It's multimeter. Electronics was a major hobby for a lot of the neighborhood folks back then. The multimeter was the first piece of test gear for most of us, and the only one for a lot of us. It could measure voltage, so we could check up on batteries. It could measure resistance, so we could disconnect a cable to tell whether a wiring connection was having problems. And those simple things were most of how most of us used multimeters most of the time. Recently, a quick poll of Facebook friends, which may be an unfair sampling since most of them are either in radio and TV or are tech journalists, but they shared how recently they had used their multimeters and for what. Their answers ran from 1 hour to several years. And for what? Here's a smattering of answers. Running down details about troublesome cables. Testing batteries. Checking the power line for brownouts. Troubleshooting power tools. Checking the 12-volt wiring on a boat. Tracking down an electrical problem on a car. Confirming which connection was which on an audio hum eliminator's power supply. Troubleshooting a battery backup sump pump. Testing AC adapters. Checking polarity and continuity on a power supply cable. Amplifier repairs. And making sure there was enough power at the outlet to support an air conditioner. Yes, that's an unbalanced sampling because these people are obviously as comfortable reaching for and using a multimeter as most folks are reaching for and using, I don't know, a hammer or a screwdriver. Some people may be wary of working with multimeters or other things that can touch wires or electricity. It's likely that even more people are simply unfamiliar with them. So what you're about to hear isn't about little nuanced tricks and isn't about the history or underlying theory of these things. It's about the practical side of things. It's about if you have a multimeter or decide to get one or somebody gives you one, what might you do with it? Well, what might you do with it that's safe? Beyond that, or other things you might be tempted to do, you'll hear about how to do those safely and what to avoid doing that might be unsafe. But why would you want to do anything with a multimeter in the first place? One reason is so that you don't ruin everything else in your kitchen junk drawer when the batteries that you keep there start leaking. One of the most common ways to use a multimeter is as a battery checker. Most of the batteries you use are 1.5-volt batteries. They may be different sizes, AA or AAA or C or D, but most say something like 1.5V right on the side. If you touch a multimeter's black probe to the flatter end of the battery and the red probe to its little button at the other end, a multimeter will tell you what voltage it really sees. If it's digital, you'll see numbers light up. If it's an analog meter with a swinging needle, look at the numbers behind the needle. What's the number? If it's between, oh, say, 1.4 and 1.9, hey, you're good. If there's a minus sign in front, you're still good. You just got the probes on the wrong ends. If it's less than 1.4, throw that battery out. You know what? It might be a NiCad. Throw it out. If it's zero, if that voltage is zero, the problem might be the battery or might be something else, like the multimeter or the probes or what you're touching on the battery. Barely adequate but workable multimeters often show up in low-price places for less than $10. They might not be worth the savings because impressive digital multimeters with extra functions and a lot of the customary things handled automatically start at less than $25. We won't get into a lot of how-to here. The internet has plenty of instructional content, and even places like iFixit.com and WikiHow can be a little too geeky for some people. So if what you find is too intense, don't blame the multimeter, just find another resource. A multimeter, hey, it starts with multi, right? Is good for more than just checking on batteries. It's also pretty good at checking on wires and connectors. And that's safe to do if they're not connected or plugged in. Is the wire still okay, or is it broken? That's called a continuity test. And a lot of today's multimeters offer that as its own function, complete with a beep that sounds if it's a good connection. Do you have a wired headphone that sounds noisy, you know, when you wiggle either end of its wire? That might show up as a crackling sound in a continuity test, or you can be more refined and read the resistance of the wire. When you wiggle the cord, does the resistance change? Know what? You just learned how to troubleshoot. If you're not practiced at working around exposed AC power, don't start just because a multimeter can tell you the actual voltage on the line. If you know only to touch insulation and never to touch the metal parts of the test probes and never ever try putting probes into an outlet when the meter is set to read current in amperes, I don't care. It's one of those times when a first mistake can be a last mistake, so read up. Find somebody who really knows what to do and get trained before you try. Or, just maybe, your multimeter offers you some other options. Look for the letters NCV. NCV. That stands for non-contact voltage, meaning that if you bring a designated part of the multimeter, usually its tip or its nose, the faraway end for you, when you bring that designated part of the multimeter near where electrical power may be, it can light up and chirp to tell you, yeah, there's live power here, without ever actually exposing or touching a power connection. Dead outlet? You'll know it in seconds. Power running behind the wall where you wanted to nail something up? That's how to avoid a nasty surprise. Until you really know what you're doing with a multimeter, stay with the simpler models. If you've never in your life owned any electronic test gear, ask yourself, when's the last time you couldn't go another day without measuring how many amps of current were flowing somewhere? Current is the thing that most multimeter owners measure the least, and sometimes never. If you do need to measure the current on AC wiring, okay, but it's safer and more convenient to get a clamp ammeter. You put its insulated section around the power wire, and it gives you that current reading without exposing any wiring. And yes, there are also clamp multimeters. Some multimeters also include functions that most people rarely use, like measuring capacitance, the value of a capacitor, or measuring the frequency and maybe duty cycle of a signal. Technical people must use test gear. For you, there will come a point where knowing a measurement for sure will make all the difference in what happens next. Is this cord any good? Is this battery any good? Is this charger working? Which do you think delivers a better answer, tested or guessed it? Remember those slick digital under $25 multimeters I mentioned? What do you bet that the cost of the meter is less than the cost of repairing or replacing something that merits testing? Listen, the multimeter is pretty simple. It's one notch above that category of gear that just checks but doesn't really measure things. Like the plug-in testers that tell you if the outlet is correctly wired, or the simple red-green battery checkers. But the difference is the back half of multimeter. The meter. The thing that shows you measurements. That can make a huge difference. Unless you're a lot deeper into electronics, you may not need more advanced tech gear like oscilloscopes or function generators, but don't be afraid of them. There's nothing scary about a multimeter, nothing sinister, not even much of anything mysterious. It's a status checker with a value system. And once you get comfortable using one, even just starting with checking those batteries, you'll find more and more to use it for. We'll just let that preposition dangle. Next time, have you ever thought about running water through the house as being a lot like running power or signals through? Beyond the basics of running power and running signals, over time, little tricks and nuances have been improving efficiency, reliability, and convenience. Can any of those apply to water pipes? Be here for our segment, What Wiring Teaches Us About Plumbing. You'll be plumb glad you did.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club for information how to join the meeting. Westchester PC User Group will have a meeting September the 3rd. Topic of presentation is audiobooks. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Network 101, installing the Internet of Things into your home or small business network, Thursday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, September the 11th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. Visit the website acgnj.org for more information on how to join the meeting. Princeton PC Users Group has their meeting on Tuesday, September the 22nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. Let me repeat that. ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Brookdale Computer User Group will have their meeting on Thursday, September the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.